Loretta Harper is a 33-year-old Gravita 2 Para 1 who underwent repeat cesarean section at 39 weeks. Her previous pregnancy 10 years ago had been complicated by gestational diabetes, fetal macrosomia, and failure to progress in labor, leading to her primary cesarean section for an 11-pound, 3-ounce infant. Since her last delivery, she was determined to have adult-onset diabetes requiring over 100 units of insulin of different types to control. With her previous pregnancy, she was overweight at 240 pounds, but since then she has gained weight and now weighs 392 pounds. Her accurate weight was determined by having her stand on two scales, 1 foot on each, and adding the two scale weights together. During the current pregnancy, her diabetes has been moderately controlled, with about half her fasting glucose levels below 90, and the other half ranging from 90 to 180. She also has asthma, for which she uses inhalers, a steroid inhaler daily, and a rescue inhaler, which she uses once or twice a month. She has been depressed and taking an SSRI in addition to frequent psychotherapy sessions. Her pregnancy has been monitored with frequent outpatient visits with maternal fetal medicine, psych, pulmonary, and endocrinology services, serial sonography for fetal growth, amniotic fluid volume, and biophysical profiling. She's decided against any more children after this one and would like a postpartum tubal ligation. At 37 weeks, her cervix was checked and noted to be long, thick, firm, closed, and the presenting part could not be felt. An ultrasound scan found the fetus to be in foot-length breech presentation with an estimated fetal weight by ultrasound of 11.5 pounds, well above the 90th percentile for this gestational age. She was counseled regarding various options for delivery, primarily scheduled cesarean section versus external version, which if successful could lead to an immediate induction of labor. Neither of these two options were attractive. Her weight, diabetes, and asthma posed significant operative and postoperative complication risks. The external version, even if successful, would leave an induction of a macrosomic baby with a known uterine scar and the resulting risk of shoulder dystocia, uterine rupture, and a fair chance of failed vaginal delivery leading to all the same surgical risks, but after a trial of labor on an unscheduled basis. Further, she ultimately would need surgery for her tubal ligation anyway, unless she could be persuaded to opt for an IUD instead. In the end, she agreed to a scheduled repeat cesarean section at 39 weeks. During surgery, her very large panniculus precluded a suprapubic entry. Instead, she had a midline abdominal incision just above the umbilicus, but because of her large abdominal panniculus, this external location of the incision led directly down to the lower uterine segment. With the weight of the subcutaneous tissues helping retract the incision open by gravity and assisted by a Mobius double-ring plastic sheet retractor, the repeat cesarean section went more smoothly than expected with delivery of an 11-pound infant through a low cervical transverse uterine incision. A Pomeroy-type tubal ligation was performed and the abdomen was closed. In closing the abdomen, they made every effort to prevent postoperative complications, notably wound dehiscence and wound infection, for which she is at high risk because of her weight, diabetes, and asthma. She received prophylactic antibiotics immediately preoperatively. Sharp knife dissection was used when needed, and the electrocautery unit, although available, was never used. Direct pressure was used to stop subcutaneous bleeders whenever possible, and hemostatic clamps and ligatures, although available, were not used. At closure, there was no subcutaneous bleeding. The abdominal fascia was closed using a continuous monofilament suture with a Smead-Jones-type closure, with half the sutures placed widely back from the fascial edges and the other half close to the fascial edges to better distribute the tension. The subcutaneous tissues were irrigated with nearly 2 liters of warm normal saline to mechanically cleanse and dilute. 3 wide and deep subcutaneous sutures were put in place to reduce tension on the cut edges of the skin and to impair seroma hematoma formation. Staples were employed to bring the skin edges together. Following surgery, she did very well, but her diabetes proved to be very difficult to control. Her asthma proved not to be a problem. She was eating the next day and ambulating. This wasn't so easy for her since she had both compression stockings and intermittent compression boots to deal with as a preventive measure against venous stasis and thrombosis. She would have gone home on postpartum day number 4, but her diabetes was still not controlled. On the morning of the 5th post-op day, the residents noticed a fever of 100.4 degrees and about a centimeter of erythema around her abdominal incision. They marked the extent of the erythema with a black marker. By the time her attending surgeon examined her later that morning, there was nearly 3 centimeters worth of erythema and warmth, and the previously dry incision has an area in the center of purulent drainage. Based on the fever, skin erythema, and purulent drainage, she was diagnosed with a wound infection. At the bedside, her staples were removed and the central area of the wound was probed with a cotton tip applicator. No anesthesia was used or necessary, as the edges of the surgical incision are usually moderately numb from the cutting of the nerves that traverse the incision line. In some patients, premedication with narcotic can be helpful in relieving anxiety and the moderate discomfort associated with this procedure. As soon as the applicator penetrated below the skin, about 10 cc's of purulent-appearing liquid drained from the wound. The remainder of the wound was then gently opened using digital extension. More purulence was released. The three subcutaneous sutures were identified, cut, and removed. Then the incision line was carefully felt and noted to be intact. Had it been open, the wound would have been covered and the patient transported to the operating room for wound revision under anesthesia. In her case, the fascia was intact. Next, the wound was cleaned up using large volumes of saline irrigation and the mechanical debridement of gauze pads gently swabbed through the depths of the incision. When finished, the wound looked much better. They then started wet-to-dry dressing changes. Take some sterile Curlix gauze or any loose gauze and soak it with normal saline, squeezing out enough that it is more than just damp but not drippy wet. Layer the gauze loosely into the wound, but make sure that it covers all the exposed tissues and reaches back into the very bottom corners of the wound. Fill the wound with this loose, wet gauze. Cover the wound with dry dressings like ABD pads. Tape the ABD pads in place around their periphery so they are not occlusive but allow some evaporation from below. Late in the day, come back, remove all the gauze, and repeat the process. This is usually done twice or three times a day. As the wet gauze dries, it adheres to any necrotic debris or tissue so that when it is removed, the necrotic debris comes out along with the gauze. This is a very fast and inexpensive method to get the wound cleaned up. After several wet-to-dry dressing changes, reevaluate the wound, and then you have several options. First, if the wound looks great with healthy granulating tissue forming, no necrotic debris, no fever, and the skin edges look good, then you can reclose the wound. Under these conditions, the likelihood of another infection forming is small, around 5%. Reclosing a wound greatly speeds the healing process. If the wound doesn't look that good, you can continue the wet-to-dry dressing changes for a while longer. The only problem with these dressing changes is that while they remove necrotic debris, they can also remove some normal healing cells, so this is not a technique to be used indefinitely. Third, you can change to sparing use of dry, loose gauze in the incision to facilitate removal of the normal healing exudate. This gauze is then covered to protect the wound against more infection and changed once a day or every other day. Fourth, for some wounds, they never look good enough to safely reclose, and they are allowed to heal by secondary intention. In this case, the wound will heal from the base up, and normal physiologic wound constriction will bring the skin edges together. This can take a long time, months, and the cosmetic results are generally okay, but a little unpredictable. If the base of the wound looks okay, but the rest is not ready for reclosure, negative pressure wound therapy can be useful. For this patient, it was necessary to open and clean out the wound infection. In addition, because of the cellulitis, antibiotics were started. She was given Augmentin until the wound cultures came back. This beta-lactam was selected because of the timing of the infection, only 5 days after surgery, at which time skin organisms such as strep and staph would be the most likely. Later infections are more likely to be from other organisms, including coliforms. Even though they tried very hard to prevent a postoperative infection, this patient had many predisposing risk factors, poorly controlled diabetes, obesity, and asthma. In the end, I expect her to recover completely.